Thanks very much, Kyle. Thanks, everybody. I must say you have made an interesting choice for your Sunday morning sermon here. And bringing a pair to talk to you, sort of like bringing the devil in to preach the gospel. But at any rate, I'm really delighted to be here. I feel quite at home, candidly, with the family medicine crowd. And, you know, I'm just going to share really just some reflections on our experience in Colorado, our experience as a payer in trying to, again, push the ball forward on primary care transformation, and, you know, some thoughts about what's most important, where to focus. So just a quick word about who and where we are as an organization. As Kyle mentioned, we're a Colorado-based organization, been around for many, many years, early 70s actually. And I think that's important because organizations like the one I'm honored to represent really have a unique opportunity to make a generational impact in their communities. And so increasingly, as we think about our mission, we're thinking about what we need to do with respect to future generations of folks in our community. We also had been a small community-based plan for many years, and that's still how we're organized. That's still our operating platform. But as of early this year, March, we were acquired by United Healthcare, which is interesting. You know, frankly, it's been a great opportunity for us in terms of being able to continue doing what we're doing in a very challenging landscape. But I think the real driver is that local plans and local organizations are uniquely positioned to work with transforming primary care practices because we're on the ground and because we actually have the opportunity for human relationships. So that certainly, I think, was a value driver in the acquisition. It's certainly going to be important to our work going forward. But, you know, when I think about the payer and the primary care practice relationship, you know, it's an interesting one because I very much believe that when we come to work in the morning, we bring with us a very similar perspective on the work we need to do for us in serving our members, for you in serving your patients. I think it stems from an overall value set and vision about prevention and allowing people to reach their greatest potential. When it comes to reform and the laundry list of acronyms that just seems to grow daily in terms of our work, at the heart of every one of those initiatives and all of those concepts is the you know, the inescapable logic that none of this can happen without a strong foundation in comprehensive whole person primary care. But we are separated, still today, after years, just through the drivers in our markets, through the very transactional nature of healthcare, certainly through the well-established fee-for-service payment model continues to be a problem, but also because, you know, the words we use and the terms that we share when we're communicating or collaborating together are different. Maybe better, if we don't take time to make sure that we're translating accurately, much get lost. And so we think that, you know, again, starting there and being intentional about communication and defining our terms and focusing on what's important will be the key to making progress going forward. And transformation is a two-way street. So as primary care practices, big and small, of every configuration, are being pushed, in many cases, well beyond their comfort zone, the same thing is happening on the payer side, although it may not seem it. Doing what we're proposing to do with whole person comprehensive primary care means a fundamental shift away from well-established business processes, regulatory structures, financial accounting methods. These are the machines, as I like to think of it, that spin at high RPM. And they're very, very well oiled. very difficult to work around in some cases. And so I think what we have to do is sort of just, you know, give each other grace. Because we're not just simply changing at the margins or working on iterative transformation. We're really trying to create a new center of gravity. With the patient at the center and the future health of the community as the North Star. And that's, you know, that's no small undertaking. And of course, the ratio of energy and effort and trial and error that goes into this versus you know, breakthroughs and learning is still not quite correct. You know, for our part, we've been at this in many ways for four decades, certainly with respect to primary care transformation as a formal strategy, almost 20 years. But we still stab around too much in the dark, and we need better evidence to guide us. And, you know, again, it's work like the work of this group that will get us there. Now, this is one of my favorite quotes. I reflect on this whenever we're taking on a new program or trying to change the way of the world. And that's just an acknowledgement that you know, innovation is hard. It is not the natural order of things. Look at our friend Niccolo there. He doesn't look too happy in that picture. I think he's got transformation fatigue, perhaps. But you know the lukewarmness sometimes, or just the weariness that we come to the table with, can sometimes be self-defeating. And so, it's just an acknowledgement that in taking this on, we have to be partners together. We have to support each other and understand, look past the little things to the bigger picture, and to persist. And persist with grit. And certainly, I think that's the culture of many of the most successful primary care practices in the work. Arnie Milstein put out a piece just a couple of days ago that I thought was very timely and certainly very helpful for me in pulling my reflections together about how primary care practices and you know, payers will work together. And of course, there's the fundamental acknowledgement that payers, in their capacity as third parties, attempting, sometimes with reflection, sometimes without reflection, to close the gap, close the many gaps in care coordination and care management and population health that really are best, the roles that are really best fulfilled by primary care, has been unsuccessful. And yet billions and billions and billions of dollars continue to go into those functions. Again, sometimes because there are no better alternatives, sometimes unthinkingly. And then we see, of course, over the last couple of years, the growth of programs that sometimes duplicate those resources, which is not a good trend. But at the end of the day, the primary care is much better positioned to coordinate care and to address gaps and real needs in the lives of whole people. The payers still have a fundamental role because so much of the work depends on creating a complete picture, a 360-degree view of the patient, better understanding about how different aspects of the network and the system are performing, better transparency, benchmarking to peers, all of those things. That's the payer's wheelhouse. We can't do it in isolation. We need to do it in partnership. But when we can make that work, there's a huge opportunity ahead. So again, I think about the payer role in the work of transformation as being you know, necessary but not sufficient. So where do we fall down? We fall down so many places. And I'll touch on some of them, and we could go on for months, of course, in these areas. The point is not just to reflect on where we have challenges and to complain about our many challenges, but just to think very practically and simply about how we can do things differently. And that requires focus. Again, the evidence that was presented in the Milstein paper, I think, will help us focus. But in my experience, this is where the greatest friction arises, even with the best of intentions when working with primary care groups, on transformation. And you know, these concepts mean different things to us. Again, I think many times we think we're talking the same language when in fact we're not, or we're trying to learn a new language. And I think, you know, for us to be successful, we're just going to have to acknowledge that. And then, of course, in the real world, we deal with real economics, real challenges with respect to how health plans and health systems and government programs interoperate or not. And that puts a tremendous pressure on our work. But again, if we can acknowledge those drivers and those issues up front and find what creative ways to work around them or work through them, we can make progress. So this is the part of the discussion where I sort of read the long list of issues and indictments, so to speak. But therein lies, within all of those complaints, the keys, I think, to the future. Measures. It's a whole new round of, I was trying to think, what graphic really depicts reality? And, you know, just a whole new round of EHR dashboarding that's grown up, of course, around the latest and greatest effort with MIPS. And yet, amid all of that activity, we are still, I think, in a world where we're trying to measure too many things all at once, certainly trying to click too many boxes. When you're measuring everything, you're not really measuring anything. I think it was very telling in the Milstein study that the practices that were characterized as performing better actually had fewer measures of focus rather than more. And so, you know, it seems as though it would be something that's easy to do, but from a policy perspective, whenever you get a group of folks in the room, you know, naturally you want to account for everything. Our perspective, at least in our work in Colorado, has been that, you know, the measurement is important. And certainly the evidence behind many of the measurements and the guidelines that drive them is important. But what we need to acknowledge is that we're still in a learning process. We're in a building process. And so using measurement as a mean to develop new competencies in quality improvement, process improvement, you know, new competencies in data use is the key. And so that really argues for a shorter list, not a longer list. And maybe with some of the evidence that's emerging, we'll begin to get there. Of course, the measures that are available to us don't serve us well in terms of whole person care or outcomes. We know that. Guideline-driven measures are critical, but you know, too narrow a focus on guidelines can lead to missed risk, because you're missing opportunities to impact future health challenges with a patient by focusing perhaps on just getting another group above or below a line. And of course, it also can lead to overtreatment. Finding what ways to better calibrate our measures with more precision to the real needs of people as whole persons, I think is the key. And there are ways to do it, and there are technologies to do that would allow us to do that, but we just need to take them on. The measures, and this isn't just a payer thing, you know, looking backwards at payer data, but really I think all of the measures in our quality improvement work, either concurrent or retrospective. What's going on today? What happened? What was missed? Not what's going to happen. You know, I'm a health plan guy, so I tend to get quite fixated on predictive modeling. But I think that really is the key to smarter measurement and smarter payment systems. You know, it's not so much what we need to do today, or certainly what happened yesterday with a patient or the patient's family in their history, but what's going to happen and what we can do, where the opportunities are. Too little work, too few of the models really focus that way. And then we think we're working in the same domains, but again, the measures kind of fail us. Health plans live in the world of HEDIS. It's a well-oiled machine. And many of the HEDIS measures overlap with you know, the measures that are emerging in clinical practice, the CQMs. But they are still fundamentally misaligned and too simplistic in many ways to get us where we need to go. The one I'll pick on is depression. And this is a This is kind of a painful one for us at the health plan. In our state and federal contracts, appropriately, Medicaid and Medicare put a lot of emphasis on diagnosis and treatment. But the measure that's available to us, or at least up to this point for the most part, has been the very simplistic, you know, look at what part of the population has a diagnosis and what prescribing has occurred. Well, of course, prescribing is not the only treatment. It's not necessarily the best. And even when you do prescribe, then as you understand it, you need to persist and calibrate with the treatment. But if that's the only measure in a model where we're increasing access to behavioral health services and primary care, we're increasing our ability to identify depression and anxiety, that measure is not going to get us there. The CQM measure is a little bit broader. At least there's a wider array of activities that can be counted as treatment. It's still a process measure. There's very little focus, even in CPC Plus, where there's a kind of a focus on rescreening and a timed relook at the PHQ. There's not a lot of discussion about what happens when the score doesn't improve, or what we actually do with that information. The point is that in trying to address something as difficult as depression, the tools that are available to us are necessary, perhaps as a start, but far from sufficient. And for us really to get to value-based, person-centered care, we're going to need better measures. Of course, regulatory and corporate inertia. You know, I've actually made this type of speech for many years now. Very little seems to change. You know, the HEDIS mechanisms seem to proliferate. The CQM mechanisms seem to proliferate on their own track through various meaningful use, MIPS, now maybe meaningful measures, whatever that is going to look like. But very little effort to bring those two worlds together, and I think we're going to fall down if we don't. Attribution, the A word, as I like to say. It's a successor to the previous A word, at least in managed care, which is assignment. They are not the same thing. From my perspective, of course, defining the population, defining the scope of accountability for payment and measurement is fundamental to value-based care and payer-provider partnership. But so much gets lost in translation. For years, auto assignment processes that the health plan had run, we would get feedback from the physicians group about, why is this patient on my list? This is not my patient. What are you doing? Don't you know that this relationship ended? In switching to attribution, that conversation is just as volatile in many cases, but it's more about where are my patients? Why don't you have this patient in? Why aren't they assigned to me? This, that, and the other thing. And I think it doesn't just stem from the fact that the attribution process is kind of rudimentary, turning on countable encounters, really just a very embryonic starting point in terms of this idea of defining a pattern of care for measurement and payment purposes. But I also think there's a deeper, conceptual difference. How payers think of their members and their members' dependents and families does indeed overlap with how primary care practices think about their patients. But, in many ways, there are big differences. Sometimes, and then likewise, I'll look at the assignment scheme within an EHR, looking whether a practice will look back over 5 or even 10 years sometimes and make assignments, and it's just as arbitrary as what the payers were doing. So we need to focus on this issue. I don't think it's a minor detail. I don't think it's just an administrative question. I think it's a kind of a telling argument in many ways about where we can close the gap and how we think about our populations. Big data everywhere in healthcare, and yet so little that's available to us, so little that's relevant. We're always just looking at our own little piece, And just the ability to do that effectively is a challenge and a multi-billion dollar effort. Why that is, I don't know. I don't think that's okay. Much of the work we've done has been to try to break down barriers and silos. But the reality is that it's going to take policy action and it's going to take community action for us to make progress here. This is not going to come from above. It's not going to come from technology. It's not going to come from the market. Those data sharing is not going to happen naturally unless we align data sharing efforts with a deeper commitment to whole person care. Of course, and this was again picked up by Milstein and team in the article recently, there's so many payers but no aggregation of the administrative data. Some states are fortunate. Colorado is relatively fortunate in this regard, both with all payer claims data efforts as well as health information exchange efforts. There are at least people that get up every day and work very hard to pull data available and make it not just available for evaluation, but also for clinical use cases. From a policy standpoint, at least in Colorado, there is a governor's level effort that's beginning to look at interoperability, beginning to look at data blocking efforts on the part of the vendors or systems or other players. That's getting around these barriers can take a lot of work. And even if we were to solve the monumental challenges with payer and clinical data, we have a whole undiscovered country, so to speak, of patient, not just patient-reported measures, but patient context. There's social determinants data. Huge county, state, and federal data sets, a wealth of potential assessment data that could be brought together more effectively for all of us. We know the social drivers are the key drivers. What gets labeled as a healthcare issue is often a behavioral, and what gets mislabeled as a behavioral issue is often a social issue. Broadening our horizons and really working with our state and local partners to pull that data in and make it useful, I think is a huge opportunity. Care management. And so I talked about this earlier. The payers have poured trillions, perhaps billions, on payer, care management over the years. Now systems, practices, array of other entities, Accountable Care is doing the same. But I think we're still missing the mark. First is the notion that coordination is not an end state. Coordination is a gap filler with respect to the fragmentation that exists within our system. And I actually don't presume that corporate integration of every aspect of care delivery is necessary or will likely occur, even though some systems have been very successful with vertical and horizontal integration. But what we ought to be talking about is how we create decentralized or community-based networks. Again, healthcare being what it is, we all tend to think in terms of command and control and in terms of platforms rather than sharing information across networks. This graph from Paul Baran from the 60s, was pretty illustrative of where I think we'd hope to go in our work with respect to how simple coordination information, not the entire record, not the entire history, not every bit of classified, regulated, confidential information needs to be shared, but simple touches and simple coordinating aspects could be more readily shared in a rights and roles-based, community-based system. But again, because of competition, because of all the other drivers, we're not going that direction very quickly. In fact, in Colorado, one of the major health systems, it's well-intentioned, but one of the major health systems actually has, I think, that graphic on the right, the centralized network platform model as their logo. and we know that that's not necessarily a vision of the future. Of course, also with all of the resources getting poured in, we are compounding the redundancies and the gaps and maldistributions, teams of 20 people from 10 different organizations will chase a discharge, but nobody will work on housing or food or safety or transportation. And so this maldistribution of and the healthcareification of every issue and need is something we're going to need to address, strategically somehow moving forward. I think it's easier to do at the community level than at the state or federal level. zero sum game, and we all experience this. In many ways, as I think of it, the pie slicing contest in most markets is just simply a natural economic behavior. But because we're not where we need to be with reform payment, because we pay for too much volume and for the wrong things, and because of the design of programs, very well-intentioned design, in some ways many logical designs, we live with this kind of tragedy of the commons. From the payer standpoint, I like to think of the STARS programs in the exchange and Medicare and now Medicaid, all HEDIS-based for the most part. It's a good thing to hold payers accountable, and those STARS programs have driven a tremendous amount of work, and a lot of it has been good. But it's designed as a zero-sum competition for premium, which in and of itself belies the fact that practices serve entire populations. Plans work in markets and have ties to entire communities. And so a model that's set up as a zero-sum game where we can't all be STARS puts further pressure or creates further impetus for segmentation. Now, here's an investment, but you can only use it with our members. Here's a report, but it's only our report for our members among the 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or other reports you have to assimilate in family practice. And that's that doesn't produce much. It produces a lot of wasted effort. With respect to risk stratification, in a system where we don't have enough adjustment in the payments, not just for risk, but for the resource intensity of patients in primary care, you get this tremendous burnout, this fatigue. It's well documented, going on for decades. But rationally, many groups are opting out. That pie slice in the middle with no crust is how I personally think of direct primary care. it's a natural reaction to a troubled system, but it certainly creates shortages and problems for the rest of the community. And so, again, there aren't easy answers. In fact, this is natural economic behavior in many ways. We just need to be aware of it. We need to find ways to work around it, work through it, or make it work for us. I'm not sure exactly what that looks like, but we try to make some of these problems bite-sized problems or manageable problems. I think it's easier to see how to contend with these issues. And smarter payments, smarter payments still are the key forward. Not fee-for-service with window dressing, not incentives and tweaks, but fundamental change is what we need to be working on. Now, as Kyle mentioned, we've been doing this stuff for a long time in Western Colorado, and frankly, we've made some progress. A pretty large share of payment, large share of the measurement model. In places like Western Colorado, where we focus, has been shifted from volume to value-ish models. Big drivers in that have been the federal programs. Comprehensive Primary Care Plus, perhaps the single best thing has happened to us in Colorado. But also related programs, the Medicaid, the state, commercial. What's happening, of course, is that practices are getting more resources than ever, getting more of the basic inputs to this model, which is a good thing. But both the practices and the payers still kind of straddle two different worlds. The volume-based world, which is still the center of gravity, and this new world, which is gaining momentum. And that's very, very difficult to do. Making the shift conceptually is challenging. Trying to live and straddle both worlds and keep the lights on is very, very daunting. I've observed over the last couple of years a kind of shift in the practice engagement where they have begun to understand and we've begun to kind of get past some of the basic communication issues around these models. And we've certainly learned in that process, and it's a bilateral discussion that's going on. But the needs have shifted. They're almost more business oriented. I get odd requests for payments sometimes at odd times, or for reports and breakouts and breakdowns that seem odd to me. Because again, from a payer, we think of practice groups, big or small, as entire organizations, not just collections of individuals. But the reimbursement, the compensation model, is still in many cases, for good reason, tied to old-fashioned volume and RVU productivity. And so I see practices taking on very gymnastic accounting. I see us trying to respond and support that. I think it's the obligation of payers to help practices with those issues, to do everything we can within our constraints to break down information in a way that makes the process of change easier, not just for the energized partner, the thought leader, but also the group he's trying to lead or she's trying to lead through this process of transformation. And we can do things to close the business intel to make this model work. Okay, so that's the long list of complaints and indictments as I think about them. But there's a lot that we can do and are doing. And again, I think narrowing our focus in some cases would be productive. But we have incredible power to make change. It's interesting, again, thinking about the relationship between payers and primary care groups. In many ways, other people think we have tremendous power, and yet we feel so constrained. You know, I routinely hear from practices, how can I possibly be responsible for the total cost of care when I have so little impact on the overall system, let alone on the choices and behaviors of my patients? It's not fair. And on the payer side, there is actually effectively so limited an opportunity to drive change at the edges of markets and competition, frankly, of kind of monopolistic scenarios with respect to healthcare delivery in some cases, very difficult to do. But we both have the opportunity to work proactively. We're both focused on the future health of our populations, and that's where we can make a big impact. Breaking this stuff down, again, we could go on for weeks and months, but I thought I'd just share today at a high level, some of the little breakthroughs and the minor changes that can improve performance in all these big domains. And attribution. So the typical process is the payer goes back, counts some claims, comes up with a method, and then sends out a list, perhaps with some useful information, perhaps not. But usually that's a one-way process entirely, except when practices or partners call and say, what's up with this list? There are ways to build bilateral validation, and I think that's essential, just like gaps in care, just like any other interaction. Where we need to improve our respective intelligence about what's going on. We can't be successful unless we have a feedback-driven process for an attribution system that reflects the actual pattern of care. In our case, again, we've developed simple little workflows, feedback mechanisms that will allow that to happen. Doing this frequently, not once every quarter or once every 6 months, but at least monthly, with a lot of feedback in between, has certainly improved attribution over the last couple years in our work. What does patient choice mean? Well, it means that the patient ought to be able to designate who their medical home provider is. It seems like a simple concept. It also, I think, at least on the payer side, is often confused with the old-fashioned processes in managed care of patient designation at the time of application. But what we're talking about here is a three-way process between the practice, the patient, and the payer that is time-limited, has to be renewed and revalidated. In our work, we've used patient choice, as it should be, as a trump for all other claims-based logic or system-based logic with respect to attribution, but a time-limited one. Because our goal with attribution is to make payments and to base measurements around active current relationships. A patient choice record can be produced really only through the practice. The practice acknowledge with the patient that a relationship exists. In our case, we've been able to use health information exchange as a way to make that process, that workflow, simpler. In our world, designating a patient choice of a practice can be as easy as issuing an order from EHR, and the health plan can receive that information. But when we do, it's good for 15 months or 18 months. It has to be renewed. And so I think that this is the key to creating a smarter attribution system. It also is key to making the payment model work, because so much of what we're kind of letting go of with respect to volume, traditional productivity measures will be addressed through things like attribution, and we need a more current patient-centered process to do that. And then again, we've got to count more than just the countable things. And I think that finding ways to not just compensate, but give credit for telehealth interactions, asynchronous practice, virtual clinic interactions through non-traditional means, non-face-to-face, non-in-person encounters will be important in driving this forward. From a policy standpoint, a little bit of progress has been made on telehealth in states and at the federal level. The new Medicaid managed care rules that CMS had put out seem to create a pathway for the first time, at least in rate-setting processes, for non-traditional interactions, asynchronous interactions, to be counted. And so, again, when we think about those, we ought to be thinking about how we pull that data in to define patient-payer or patient-practice relationship, not just countable claims. Data sharing. So I think that the key here is taking the big, abstract, scary, expensive concept and boiling it down as simply and as practically as possible. And that starts, again, with a conversation. In our cases, or in our case in Colorado, we've spent millions and millions of dollars on health information exchange, data aggregation, reporting, and analytics. So with a lot of effort, that's created a kind of a foundation for a more partnership-driven data sharing process. But amid all of that, we've got to, amid all of the noise, what we've had to do is carve out time to sit down with leading practices around the state of every type, every configuration, FQHCs, system-owned, small groups, big groups, and define some clinically pertinent use cases. What does that mean? Well, in your long laundry list of measures, what are you really focused on? And within those measures, where are there better opportunities for more meaningful care management, more proactive, more predictive care management? Where would more data help? Just simply replicating what appears on a payer report or an EHR dashboard is kind of pointless. The opportunity is to use shared data to come up with more impactful, better targeted care management models and clinically pertinent models. And so, in our case, we've worked with the physicians to identify three different areas, three different value sets for the measure. So looking at the data elements behind the CQM sometimes is very instructive. And then because there are no federal standards, really, I want to be careful because there's been a lot of work done on things like continuity of care documents and so on. But because there's really not a federal or an industry-driven interoperability standard, it falls to us at the community level to develop our own specs and standards. In Colorado, in the context of our SIM and CPC Plus work, we started to do that, developing, again, a state-level, community-level, practice and payer-supported set of standards. It says when we go out and look for the elements behind the diabetes management measure, the depression measurement, depression management measure, this is what we're going to look for, and this is how it has to come over, and we're all going to work from the same standard, and that begins to make a world of shared analytics available. We've also shared tools, so rather than just working in our own platforms, which is essential, we've at least collaborated through the multi-payer collaborative on a shared analytic tool that includes all the payer data, the Medicare data, the Medicaid data, as well as some clinical data that's collected from Health Information Exchange. All possible, not because there was a top-down solution, but because we drove our own spec setting process. And it can be done, just takes an investment of time and leadership, several early morning phone calls and webinars, but we've been able to move the ball forward. And the coordination, of course, I touched on this. The key is to work across the systems and the silos at the community level, and I think particularly with respect to social determinants data, we need to shift to kind of shared extensible architecture. What does that mean? That means a model where everyone can participate because we're not sharing every bit of sensitive information. We just have a community-based solution through Health Information Exchange or similar that allows us to understand what happened to somebody. And this is particularly important with respect to social transitions. When somebody loses eligibility for a program, when housing changes, when there's a criminal justice event, whatever the case may be, having a feedback mechanism where we can share those social alerts as well as healthcare transition alerts is a huge opportunity. Not just to respond faster and more intelligently, maybe avoid another spate of unnecessary healthcare utilization, but to make a more meaningful impact on the person's life. So they can tell their story once, and we can provide more meaningful assistance. In our work, again, we are getting that off the ground. There is a federal program, a federal model test called AHCM, Accountable Health Communities, that we're participating right now to help move that forward. But there's a lot of creativity, a lot of work, and frankly, I think a lot of investment, not just in the public sector, private sector, that's going to come along in this area. What practices will get out of that? Well, they'll get many things, certainly better support for their patients. But the key, as I mentioned, is that, so much of our payment model is driven by demographics and diagnosis. And my own plan, as well as many payers, CMS itself, takes these kind of old-fashioned HCC-style risk adjustment models, which are designed for plans and communities and payers, and have been applying them to primary care. CPC payments are risk-adjusted using the HCC. Our payments are risk-adjusted. And that does have the effect of shifting more dollars towards patients with greater complexity, but it also misses opportunities at the tails, as I like to think of it. So many times a patient will be very resource intensive because of social risk factors in primary care, but not diagnostically complex, and we end up underpaying for that patient. We end up overpaying for patients that are diagnostically complex but well managed elsewhere. And so working at the community level to bring about this type of architecture and to share data with a broader array of trading partners, it will be the key, I think, to addressing the fact and the fundamental dissatisfaction I think many primary care practices have about whether or not risk adjustment really works as a payment model for their group. Okay. So much of this, though, depends on you know, multi-payer collaboration, multi-payer alignment. We don't have a single payer. Whether that's a good or bad thing, I honestly don't feel that strongly about it. But in our current state, it's imperative that payers work in a policy environment that encourages collaboration. And it plays out in meaningful work to reduce, consolidate, and align the laundry list of measures to bridge the divides between clinical and administrative measures, to create a true 360 degree picture of the population, at least on the administrative side, to produce more meaningful peer benchmarking, which is a key driver to the model. That can't happen unless folks come to the table. And the coming to the table does not necessarily entail the writing of a statute. In Colorado, no statutes have been written, and we have a very productive multi-payer collaborative across 5 or 6 different major payers supporting CPC, SIM, and related projects. Even Medicare ACO projects have grown up and have been evolved somewhat through this multi-payer process. But it took a first mover. And so while no statutes have been written, the fact that Medicare in particular came to the table and said, we're gonna do our alternative payment model and there's a lot of opportunity in it, but only if the other payers come along and get into alignment, that's huge. And keeping that going, I think, will be key to many of the other issues I've talked about. We're fortunate to have that little virtuous cycle started in Colorado. I'd like to expand and find ways to sustain it. It exists in too few markets, and again, I think that there are things that can be done at the policy level, particularly through Medicaid and Medicare action to bring this about. Okay, I'll wrap up here quickly and we can talk. The thing that is key also with respect to risk adjustment and resource adjustment is moving towards a stratification process that really accurately reflects all the risks and needs of a patient. And in our case, we spent a fair amount of time over the last couple of years working on the 4-quadrant model for behavioral health integration, which is a simple 4-quadrant, low, high, high, low kind of stratification process, largely based on diagnosis, that has allowed us to kind of design programs and payments for primary care that support behavioral health integration. And of course, that has also helped us greatly with respect to thinking about our own care management processes more holistically. It's far from sufficient. And so very recently, we made a conscious, intentional effort to shift to what we call a 3-dimensional model, shift away from the 4-quadrant to more intentionally pull, in many cases, the very same folks in, but with a wider array of risk factor drivers, social risk factor drivers, into a whole person model. And at the center of that concept, of course, you find many of the same patients you would expect to find, but there are some that you wouldn't. And I think also we have the opportunity to be more proactive rather than reactive with respect to engaging in their well-being. And so, really it's all about unmet needs, anticipating them more effectively. And we think that this framework will help us in moving forward. The way it plays out practically, and again, we're kind of at the outset of this in our own work and with our practices, but the way it plays out practically is to take all of the data that we normally have. Here you've got an HCC-style risk adjuster with groupings showing acuity and prevalence across four quadrants. But we've also overlaid all of the social factors information that we can glean and scrape together, primarily from assessments, but increasingly from community partnerships with counties and other community service providers, and begin to layer in those risks and prevalences in our targeting. And you know, we have very limited data, and it's a very entry-level process. But what you see at the top of the list, down there in the bottom segment of this chart, is that there are simple indicators that show social risk that sometimes are not necessarily aligned with what we would see if we're looking at diagnostic factors. Multiple system touches, multiple care coordinator involvement, of course, transportation rises to the top, and then several other social factors. But if we can find a way to integrate this type of data in our targeting, as I said, I think we'll be in a better position to help practices in delivering whole person care and coming up with smarter payment mechanisms. So, again, I think that there are many things we can do to bridge the divide. It's going to take persistence. It does take policy action, as I said, with respect to the things like multi-payer. But really, a lot of our work can be done at the community level. It can be done just simply by talking, by narrowing our focus, having better understanding about our respective priorities, which are in many cases aligned, and just starting the process. I've found many times that while regulatory, payment, and technology issues can be drivers or barriers, the single biggest challenge is almost always human and organizational. I'm very hopeful that we can continue, at least in our case, to collaborate with our primary care leaders to move the work forward. So I'll, after that very long discussion, turn it over to questions or to dialogue. Again, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you guys this morning and interested in your feedback.